We are making a shift in our class this morning. We have been studying the book of Numbers, and we have been calling it by the Hebrew title, the Book of Wilderness. And we finished that book last Sunday as they are on the doorstep of the Promised Land. We are now going to begin the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, the title means the second law or the second giving of the law. And it comes from the Greek Old Testament, Greek version of the Old Testament. But then the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew had a tradition in that they would name the book by the first major word in that book. And so the first major word in the book of Deuteronomy is words. The book of words. And so this basically sums up the book of what this book is about. It's the words that Moses gives by God, obviously. I'm teaching this morning. It is the book of words, the words that Moses gives to the people before they enter into the land. And so we will be studying the book of words this morning. And throughout these next few weeks. Deuteronomy, what do we know about the book of Deuteronomy? Anything? What do we commonly think of when we think of Deuteronomy? Second law? Who wrote it? Moses. Moses is the author. Now, when we think about authorship, the authorship of Deuteronomy is a little bit contested. In the critical theology, it is quite contested. The book itself, in several places, says that Moses is the author. Deuteronomy 5:1. I'll say these a couple times if you're taking notes. Deuteronomy 5:1. Deuteronomy 29:2. Deuteronomy 29:2, and then chapter 31, verses 24 through 26, state that Moses wrote this book. Those of higher critical thinking, which means nothing really, but they studied a lot, waste a lot of money in college. So those of higher critical thinking believe that this version or this second law was actually what was found by the priests during the time of Josiah, during the time of King Josiah. So they believe that this book was written in about 691, about 691 or 692, and was just, you know, one of those things that was found when they were cleaning out the temple. And so they higher critical people would think that, well, it was written during a time when people were kind of gullible, and the priest passed this off as a second giving, or the book of Moses, the lost book of Moses, and it is not really inspired. It was just kind of a ploy that the priests used during that time to get things kind of turned around. And but we would not. The Bible doesn't teach that. The book itself claims authorship, and then we're going to look at some other things. Jesus quoted from it. Peter, Paul. Everybody quoted from the book of Deuteronomy, and so that lends itself to know that it is inspired. It is an inspired work, and we'll talk about that more extensively later on. The setting. What is the setting? Where are we right now? If you were with the people of Israel, where would you be right now? Do you remember? Where do we end off at the end of the book of Numbers, location wise? Where are we? Yes, we're on the plains of Moab, right on the other side of the Jordan River, right across the way from Jericho, basically. We are poised to go into the Promised Land. That's where the people are. That's where we ended at the end of the book of Numbers. That's where we are right now during the writing of this book. And if you want to write down Deuteronomy 1:3. Well, basically, Deuteronomy, the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 1 through chapter 34, covers 40 days. Covers a period of 40 days. We give a time stamp at the very beginning of this book. In chapter 1, We're given that this book was written in the 40th year, counting down from when they came out of Egypt, in the 40th year, the 11th month, and the first day. And then Joshua gives us, Joshua 4:19, Joshua tells us that they go into the promised land in the 41st year, the first month, and the 10th day. So about 30 days after they finish writing this Deuteronomy, they are entering into the promised land. So from the time this book starts to be written until the time they cross the Jordan into the promised land, we're talking about 70 days. 70 days. And so we're at the last little bit before they cross over and start conquering the promised land. So time stamp, that's where we are. Location, we're just right on the cusp there of going into and fulfilling that promise. I'll give you a brief outline, just so we can know where we're going to be going with this. The book of Deuteronomy is basically a series of lessons from by God, delivered through Moses, warnings and exhortations to stay faithful. Remain obedient is the basic theme throughout the book of Deuteronomy. And so Moses gives these four addresses. And so chapters, Roman numeral 1, if you want to write this down, Roman numeral 1 are four addresses by Moses. Four addresses by Moses, chapters 1 through 30, give us those four main lessons from Moses. Lesson 1 is chapters 1 through 4, and we get a review. 1 through 4, we're basically going to be giving a review of everything we looked at in Numbers, their time coming out of Egypt, and how God worked with them. In chapters 5 through 26, we are given again that second law. We're going over the Ten Commandments, chapters 5 through 26. We have laws and exhortations. Chapters 27 and 28, we have this covenant renewal. Chapters 26 and 28, or 27 and 28. And then chapters 29 and 30, we have again exhortation of obedience. And so these lessons that are given to the people. Now Moses knows that he's not going into the promised land. And so he exhorts them time and time again to remain faithful. And he tells them what will happen if they do not remain faithful. And of course, we have it all written out before us. And so we can confirm what Moses is warning them about. Roman numeral 2 for this book is the closing words and some events in basically chapters 31 through 34. You have the final commands in chapter 31, the song of Moses in 32, the blessing of Moses 33, and 34 we have the recorded death of Moses. And so the bulk of this book are lessons or addresses to the people to remain faithful, be obedient, do not leave the path. Do not stray away from what God's done for us. And so you can see how that would be really relevant to us. The same message, the same concept to us, to remain faithful. And we talked about this in relationship to the book of Hebrews. Don't fall short of the promise. Don't fall short of the promise. And when stay faithful to God. I guess we'll stop there with that. Any questions or anything before we go on? Did y'all get that? All right. I know some of you are writing furiously, so I'm making sure that you have time to get that. As we mentioned before, Deuteronomy is used extensively in the New Testament. And that's how we know for sure that it is an inspired work, specifically when Jesus is quoting from Deuteronomy. Right after Jesus' baptism, what happens in Matthew chapter 4? Where does Jesus go after his baptism? Into the desert, into the wilderness. He's there for 40 days, 40 nights. He's tempted. And while he's there, or towards the end of this time there, Satan comes to tempt him. Jesus quotes exclusively from the book of Deuteronomy during that time. So Deuteronomy chapter, or rather Matthew 4 through 10, Jesus is quoting from the book of Deuteronomy. He quotes from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 13. And chapter 6, verse 16, and then chapter 8, verse 3. Jesus is quoting from the book of Deuteronomy, which, as we said before, the higher critics, theologians, would say that this was a letter that was, or a scroll that was written during the time of King Josiah. But according to Jesus, it was a book that was written by Moses, and it is inspired by God. And so I'll take his word over theologians. How about you guys? Okay. Also another individual, Paul uses it in Romans 10:8 and 1 Corinthians 9:9. Peter quotes it in Acts chapter 3, verses 22 and 23. And then again, it's quoted in Acts 7:37. So it is extensively used, and there's a lot more. It's used quite extensively in the book of Hebrews, but we don't have time to go into all of that. It is used quite a bit in the New Testament. So the New Testament, and again, using the Bible to be its own commentary, the New Testament says it's an inspired work. And so that should be enough for us. I'm going to go over just some things, seven factors that made Deuteronomy necessary. We're sort of in a new situation here. And so seven factors that made Deuteronomy necessary to be given to the people at that time. We are talking to, and Moses is writing to, a new generation. What happened to the old generation? What happened to the ones prior? They died. They're gone. All the red shirts are gone. And so now we have the new generation that's arisen. And number two, a new land of religious corruption. They're going into a new land of religious corruption. They left one land of religious corruption, and God showed himself to be powerful over their gods. Which, by the way, there's a new movie coming out, The Gods of Egypt. And I'm going to be able to watch that movie and say, yep, my God took care of all those. So so he showed himself to be more powerful than the gods of Egypt. He's about to show himself to be more powerful than the gods of Canaan as they go into this new land of corruption, religious corruption. They've already experienced that. Remember when you had those apparently good-looking ladies come in and corrupt them earlier? When Phinehas had to take things into his own hands with a spear, and the 24,000 people died. So they've already experienced some of that corruption. And so that's another reason why they need to remain firm. They're going to be experiencing new dangers, new prospects. Number four, new prospects. New challenges, militarily, economically, spiritually, they're going to be facing new challenges. As they go into this land, they're going to be transitioning from a semi-nomadic lifestyle to an agricultural lifestyle. Which, what does that mean to you? I don't think very few of us are semi-nomadic. I guess would snowbirds be semi-nomadic? Maybe. Okay. So we're transitioning into a new lifestyle for these people. So here's a generation who have grown up just wandering around the desert and God throwing birds and bread at them, and now they're going to go into this new land and they've got to cultivate and grow up. And we're going to see that in the book of Deuteronomy. When you go into a new land and you have houses you didn't build and vineyards you didn't plant, don't forget God. And we're going to see that in this, some challenges with that in this book. So transitioning from a different lifestyle. And then we have a new leader. And last, number seven, they'll have a new leader. Joshua will stand up and be that leader. And it's interesting, when we saw that transition was going to take place in the book of Numbers, Moses was able to talk with God. And while God gives Joshua messages from time to time, he does not have that same close relationship like Moses had with God. Because remember, we were told that Joshua would have to consult the Urim and the Thummim to determine what God wanted. But God just spoke with Moses prior to this. And so that's a new leadership with sort of a new relationship, a different relationship, not as close as the one that Moses had with God. And so that's going to be new in several accounts. And I want to give you also three fundamental truths that the book of Deuteronomy kind of reestablishes with these people. And we'll see this and we'll make note of this as we go through the book. But three fundamental truths that that is reaffirmed in Deuteronomy. One, that Yahweh is unique. Yahweh or God is unique. Deuteronomy 4:35. Deuteronomy 6:4 in the Shema that's quoted, and then Deuteronomy 10:17. Yahweh is unique. Also, number two, Israel is a unique people. Deuteronomy 7:6. Deuteronomy is a unique people. Let's look at that in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 6. If I can find it faster. You guys are just doing the whole loop. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 6. You are a holy people to the Lord your God. Though the Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. How would that make you feel if the God of heaven, who has wrought these wonderful works, marvelous things you can't really even comprehend, who spoke on a mountain when you were a kid, spoke on a mountain and you didn't want to listen, you were afraid, you still have nightmares about that rumbling mountain when God spoke. And this God is telling you, you're my special people. This is the God that's saying, you're mine. Out of all the other nations around, you're my special people. How would that make you feel? What would you think? That'd be kind of nice, right? That'd be kind of neat. And we see that transition into the New Testament, and you see that sort of elitist attitude gone sour in some people who think, they were still supposed to be nice and humble. They were still supposed to be, you know, not be jerks about it. But you see, like the Pharisees shaking the dust off their sandals when they've passed through Samaria and that kind of stuff. And so you see this attitude transition into a sour, elitist attitude in the New Testament when they took things way too far and took things very differently than that should be taken. But we see why. God chose them out of all the other people. And it's not, ladies and gentlemen, that God didn't have a relationship with anybody else. We know that God had a relationship with other nations because of Jethro, because of Melchizedek. These were people who had relationships with God. We mentioned Balaam knew God. And so there was something that God had a relationship, but he didn't have a chosen people like this. He didn't dwell with a people like this. This is very different. They were very unique. And so this is very similar to what Peter talks about us, a royal nation, a royal priesthood. And so we can have that. So we have that relationship that is opened and extended to everyone who accepts that relationship. And then lastly, Israel and God had a unique relationship. And that's reaffirmed in chapter 29, verse 13, 32:6. So those are, again, a unique relationship. We sort of hit on that with this one also.
Josh.
Yes, sir. Oh yes, and you're exactly right. It's because of the Christ. It is, as you read through the Old Testament, we start off in Genesis with the beginning of mankind and everybody, right? Everybody. And then we narrow down to the story of Noah and we have like eight people left on the planet. So the population goes from everybody to eight people, whittles down. And then we blow up again population-wise. We have the Tower of Babel and that kind of stuff, and everybody. So the story in beginning Genesis is global history, global story, right? And then it narrows down when we get to whom?
Abraham.
The story begins to narrow down, and we start to deal with one people. And we're going to see in just a few minutes in these chapters that God still had a relationship with the descendants of Esau, the descendants of Lot, and other people. But the story that we're focusing on and the beginnings that Moses gives to the people is that you're from Abraham. These are the promises that were given to you. And so our story narrows down. And it is, you're exactly right. In Genesis chapter 12, in you and your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. And that seed promise is what carries us through, and we see Christ sprinkled, and we've already seen it in Numbers, and we see Christ sprinkled throughout the Old Testament because of Christ. You're exactly right. And that's why. So God is with these people to raise up the sacrifice. This was all to bring about the sacrifice. And so if you think about the work and the patience and how God had to deal with these people, it's all because of Christ. And it's ultimately all because of his relationship with you. Yes, if they were able to understand that concept, that this was to be a bigger picture later on, then maybe it would have changed their concept of themselves. But, I mean, that's hard. That'd be hard to expect of them. And we, having it all written out before us, sometimes forget that's really what this is all about. And exactly. And that lineage brings about that relationship for all of us. So that sacrifice could be made so that all of us could be a peculiar people, a chosen people. Let's look at Deuteronomy 18, and just to give us a snippet of things to come concerning this. Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 14 through 20. It was to the end of this chapter, or rather 15 through 20. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me, Moses speaking, from among you, from your countrymen. You shall listen to him. This is according to all that you asked of the Lord your God in Horeb on the day of assembling, saying, let me not hear again of the voice of the Lord my God. Let me not see this great fire anymore, or I will die. And that's what we're talking about on the mountain. Moses interceded so they didn't have to basically be scared to death, is what they were basically saying. And the Lord said to me, they have spoken well. I will raise up a prophet from among their countrymen like you, and I'll put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. It shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. But the prophet who speaks a word presumptuously in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or which he speaks in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die. And you must, so we see very clearly that Christ, and you know, this is for them, when they saw this, they weren't thinking, oh, he's talking about Jesus. They weren't thinking that. They were thinking Joshua, they were thinking in the future any other prophet that was raised up, and there were others that were raised up. But the ultimate fulfillment of this, and we know this is Christ because it's quoted in Acts concerning Christ, this is eventually talking about the Christ, a prophet that will be risen up. And Christ tells us in John chapter 14 and John 16 that the words that he spoke were not his words. They were the words of God. He channeled those words, he was given the words, and he spoke them. And so it's interesting also that he was called the Word. And so it is an interesting study looking at Christ. And so that's sort of a snippet into the future. And again, they're not seeing that. It's impossible for them to really comprehend that's even going to be coming about. But we know because we have it all written out before us. We have the whole story. So any other comments, questions before we jump into Deuteronomy? All right. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 1. Here we go. Roman numeral 1, chapters 1 through 30. We're starting the four addresses by Moses. Chapters 1 through 4, we have a review. Why do you review, by the way? Just teachers out there, why do you review anything?
To bring it back into your memory.
To bring it back into your memory, so you don't forget. So you don't forget, right? What are the four R's of learning? Repetition, 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 right? So, did I say four or three?
Three.
Okay. Sometimes I'm off on my numbers, but anyway. So here we are, chapter 1. We're given a place and timestamp in the first few verses. And verse 3 talks about what time this is, and then Moses begins to speak. And then he starts going over the different things that happened. He talks about the time in Horeb in verse 6. Verses 9 through 18, he talks about the need for judges. Remember how the people were just too much for him to handle by himself, and so there were judges that were raised up to judge among the people for the small things. Somebody stole my cart, he killed my mule. You know, Moses didn't have time for that kind of stuff, and so he appointed judges among the tribes to take care of that. And verse 10, we have an interesting comment here. The Lord your God has multiplied you, and behold, you are this day like the stars of heaven in number. Have you heard that somewhere before? You are like the stars of heaven. If you want to write out there Genesis 22:17, if you're in the habit of writing in your Bible, which it's okay, you can do that. Genesis chapter 22:17. We have this, God said that very same thing to Abraham after the period where, after the time when he asked him to sacrifice Isaac. And so he says, this very day you have achieved that. Did Moses ever, or rather, did Abraham ever see that promise? Never saw it. But by faith, he knew that would happen. In verse 16, he says, then I charged your judges at that time. I charged your judges. And so here's, after the book of Joshua, we have the book of Judges. And here's where that concept kind of comes from. They were given appointed judges to, so here's where that concept kind of comes from. And then chapters 20, or verses 22 through 25, you have the time when the spies were sent out. And so he goes over that again. And then they decide that they are not going to go in, verses 26 through 33. And so he's reminding them, again, we're about to go in and conquer, and we're about to do this all again. It's very important to remind you, here's what happened last time. You better not do this again, right? This will not be Pete and repeat in a boat, okay? So you're going to do this the correct way this time. Look at verse 31. Verse 31, and in the wilderness where you saw how the Lord your God carried you, just as a man carries his son in all the way you have walked until you came to this place. What image is God using in his relationship with his people? What image is he using?
Father and son.
Father and son. Can we relate to that? Can we relate to that? What is it that's unique about, or what is it that we think of when we think of a father-son relationship? And what is special about that relationship? All right, well, let me say it this way. Is a father and son relationship different than just friends or buddies, or What is it that's different about a father and son relationship that's different than other? There's a bloodline.
There's a sense of responsibility.
Yes, a sense of responsibility for. What about the, what responsibility does the son have to the father?
The honor
to respect and look up. Look at Hosea chapter 11. Hosea chapter 11. God uses this throughout the Old Testament in his relationship with Israel. Hosea chapter 11, verses 3 and 4. He said, yet it is I who taught Ephraim to walk. And when he mentions Ephraim, he's talking about Israel. And he says, it is I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of a man, with bonds of love. And I became to them as one who lifts the yoke from their jaws. And I bent down and fed them. This is a close relationship that God is talking about having with his people. I dealt with them as a father deals or handles or works with a child. That is a very close relationship. That is a very loving relationship. And there would be those who would tell you that the God of the Old Testament is different than the God of the New Testament. Have you heard that before? That the God of the Old Testament is all about, you know, condemnation and is all about killing folk and is all about, you know, that. And the God of the New Testament is love and peace and joy and hippie sandals. You know, so they give. You've heard it said that. Okay, I'm not repeating anything that hasn't been said before. But do you get that when you actually read the Bible? Do you see that difference? I'm not seeing it here. I'm not seeing it here. Yes, he dealt differently. Yes, he worked differently. It even says in the New Testament that it's different now. But his concern for his people, his love and close relationship that he wants with his people has not changed. Never changed. Yes, sir. Yes, there was, on God's part, there was a drive to, like, this is the way you need to go in order for all promises to be fulfilled. So there's a focus on the fulfillment of promises. Yes, so as you're saying...
a lot of people, the reason why I bring that up, a lot of people see that as being the difference. You know,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Strong arm and all that.
Yes.
Well,
the big reason why God had other people kill, you know, other nations and that kind of stuff. One, Israel was a holy nation, and we don't really. I think sometimes we forget. You know, we say that on the maybe the front of your Bible, it says Holy Bible and that kind of stuff, but we forget what holy is, and how extreme it is. The book of Leviticus is how an unholy people approaches a holy God. And you look at all the different ways that they had to approach them. And so why was God saying, you got to be holy? You can't be corrupt. Sin requires a death. And until a new covenant comes around, this is the one we're under. And he was physically on earth, dwelt with people. He had a physical, the Shekinah glory of God was with his people. And you had to be holy in the camp. You couldn't mess around and just do whatever you wanted to. You had to be holy. And so that's why it was different. God demanded that. It's not that he's demanded any less. The same thing is demanded of us. We're under a different covenant, and how we approach God is different because of that sacrifice. But we still need to be holy. We cannot forget the price of holiness. We cannot forget the price of holiness. And Christ was that price for us. And you're exactly right. There is this fulfillment of promises, and then there is, in the New Testament, promises have been fulfilled. You're just waiting your reward. And so that imagery there, again, works well with the wilderness wandering. We're in the wilderness waiting our fulfillment of promise. And so that close relationship is given to us here in... Again, and we'll see it as you read through the Old Testament, you'll see this come up over and over again. Verse 32, here's the reason why they didn't go in the first time. But for all this, for all that I've done for you, you did not trust the Lord your God. What it boils down to, why they didn't go in the first time, is they did not trust God. You didn't trust me. And so that's, again, something that's repeated over again when people forget to trust God. What more did he have to do? What more did he have to do to earn the trust of these people? Verse 34, 34 through 40, God condemns the faithless. And so we have, again, those who, verse 35, not one of these men, these evil generation, shall see the good land. And so we're given that here. And then verse 41 through the end, they said that that's that time when they tried to, oh, we're just kidding, we'll go in, we'll take it. And they tried to go in and take the land, and God said, you know what, I'm not going with you. And Moses was kind of sitting there by the front of the temple saying, you know, the tabernacle saying, hey, God's not going to go with you. You're going to die. Don't go over there and do that. But they try to do it anyway. Have you seen little kids say, I do it, I do it? And you know they're not going to be able to do it. And That's what happened. Chapter 2, 1 through 7, you have passing through the land of Esau. And this is interesting. Well, we weren't given this necessarily in the first review of this. Chapter 5, or verse 5 of chapter 2, he says, "Do not provoke them, for I will not give you any of their land, even as little as a footstep, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession." So Esau was given a land possession by God. And then we'll see later on in verses 8 through 15, they passed through the land that was given to Lot. And we're given sort of a time-lapse period here also. But in verse 9, he says, "I have given Ar to the sons of Lot as a possession." And so that's what we were given there. And then verse 15, it's reiterated again, "Moreover, the hand of the Lord was against them to destroy them from within the camp until they all perished." And he's talking about those who were faithless, who were supposed to die in the wilderness. And so as I read this verse, I just think of like all the different ways they could have died in the camp. I mean, we're not given all the different ways. We're given a lot of, 24,000 died at one time, and this amount of 100 died there because they were, trying to stand against God and the rebellion of Korah when the ground just kind of opened up and swallowed them. I just still don't grasp the concept of the ground opened up and ate people. And the next day, they haven't even moved camp. They're still in that same area. The next day, they're fussing against Moses. I just don't grasp that concept. But so I just imagine, as they're in the hand, this is what the text says, the hand of the Lord was against them that they would die. And I'm not sure what's happening. Are they tripping on tent stakes and dying? Are they just like all these awkward ways that they're dying because the hand of the Lord was against them? We don't know. But they died in the wilderness. And so that's just my twisted sense of humor on that. Sorry. 16 through 25, all the fighting age had died. We went through. And so they begin to take some of the land. They begin to take that land that's on the west side, the land that they eventually, some of them would settle in. Look at verse 25. This is very important. So they're fighting against some of these kings. And he said, "This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you upon the peoples everywhere under the heavens, who when they hear the report of you will tremble and be in anguish because of you." And so God starts to use them to start punishing, taking kings and punishing kings because the kings start fighting against them. And God says, "All right, now you're going to be the big guy on campus and everybody's going to be afraid of you." And he says, "I will put the fear of me in them. I will put the fear in them." And we see this when we get into Joshua, right? What does Rahab say? Everybody's afraid of you. Everybody's afraid of you. And I think it's, I don't know, psychologically a game God plays with Jericho to make him walk around seven times. Could you imagine how they've already torn down walled cities? This is not a new thing. A walled city is not a new thing. And so in Joshua, they're walking around that walled city seven times. And I'm sure the people are just freaking out. What are they going to do? What are they going to do? What are they going to do? All right. So we'll end there at the end of chapter 2. And then we'll finish up next week and hopefully get into, be finished with the review. Any questions or comments before we finish? All right. Thank you very much for your time this morning.